Welcome to the 40 and Infertile podcast, where I share with you my fertility journey in my late 30s and 40s while also providing you information to minimize your fertility struggles later in life.
Hey everybody, this episode is on sperm donation and sperm banks. And today's guest is Elise of Seattle Sperm Bank. And we talk about sperm donation, sperm banks, and everything that's involved with that whole process. And this came about because of my episode with Kristen at Just Be Kristen on Instagram. And she had such a great experience. I thought I would find out what makes them so different for anybody who needs a sperm donor, to really demystify the process. And to be completely honest, I have no idea what's involved in it. And prior to this episode, I didn't know anything about sperm banks or sperm donation or the process for those who are seeking a sperm donor. So if this is you, if you're in the process of trying to figure out which sperm banks to use or what the sperm bank process is like if you're needing a sperm donor, then this is your episode. If you're curious about Kristen's episode or her experience, you can find her experience in episode 42. So we start with the basics and kind of what's involved in the donation process from the donor perspective and how they screen their donors, and then what happens after donation, and then the limitations on donors, families, and then what to expect if you use their sperm bank. Thank you, Elise, for being so helpful and for sharing this information with families who may need the help of a sperm donor in their expansion of their families. And I want to thank you all again for your patience. Again, this was recorded quite some time ago. So thank you so much, you guys, for being here. Thank you, Elise, and thank you, Kristen, for this information to kind of get us started. I hope you guys enjoy. Just a quick reminder, I am not a physician, and the information provided today is for educational and informational purposes only, and is not a substitute for professional medical advice. So make sure that you consult with your own fertility doctor before choosing any medical therapies that may affect your fertility. Unfortunately, every person's situation is unique, and it is vital that you discuss your own personal situation with your fertility doctor to decide what is the best course of action for you. All right, we're back with another episode today. Thank you guys for being here. And thank you, Elise from Seattle Sperm Bank, for joining us today. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I first heard about Seattle Sperm Bank after having Just Be Kristen, on the show talking about independent parenthood and talking about her experience. And she really just had some really amazing things to say about Seattle Sperm Bank and why she chose Seattle Sperm Bank. So I'm excited to kind of dive deep into some of the things that make you different, but I think also just to take some of the mystery out of sperm banks and what sperm banks do, and you know, how someone can find the right sperm bank for them, and then kind of just the entire process for anyone looking for a sperm donor. So thanks for being here and sharing all of that with us.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about sperm.
not many people can say that in their daily vernacular, so this is awesome.
I'm here for seeing more families use it, and anybody who needs help with it, and I've got some answers.
yes, so great. Well, let's learn a little bit more about you and a little bit more about Seattle Sperm Bank. I understand you have your own fertility story, but also you kind of had this long love affair with reproductive health.
I like that, a love affair. Way back in undergrad, I discovered the whole world of embryology and fertility, and it's just so cool to me. I love the science behind it. I love that it's a brand new field, and I love helping people. So it kind of combined science and helping and making babies, and who doesn't love all of that? And so I ended up getting I completed my bachelor's, and then I got a master's in reproductive clinical science from Eastern Virginia Medical School, which is very cool on its own because EVMS was the first IVF clinic in the U.S. and the work they did there actually resulted in the first IVF baby in the U.S. So it was really meaningful to be able to be a part of that program. Yeah, it was a very cool place to go if you're into fertility. I had my daughter while attending EVMS, and my husband and I then decided sometime later that we were going to have a second child. And I unfortunately had a miscarriage and then was unable to conceive after that loss. So we went, me being in this field, I thought, I can see something's wrong. I'm tracking my ovulation. I'm doing all the things. I'm reading all the posts. I'm in all the groups. And something wasn't right. So I went and got a full fertility workup, and they ended up diagnosing us with unexplained secondary infertility. And secondary because we already had a child. So I went through a full IVF cycle. They took out eggs, and my husband was so embarrassed to go into the lab and do his part. It was very sweet. And we ended up getting only one embryo. So I definitely went through the roller coaster of, how many eggs did I get and how many of those turned into blast. And it was so different being on the patient side. On the school side, I knew what should be happening and I knew what it should look like. And so being on the patient side, I was then, you're so emotionally involved and you're so emotionally tied to these numbers and reading stats. And we ended up with one embryo. We transferred her and it resulted in a pregnancy and again, another loss. So both of my losses were unexplained, and having gone through that emotional struggle with that and not really feeling like I had anything else to do, we decided, well, let's check out adoption. So we explored both private and foster care adoption. We went through classes. But ultimately, we're at a point where we're kind of done family building, where it was a lot of years. It's a lot of emotions. And we've kind of landed in this spot where it feels good to kind of close the book on that. It doesn't, it wasn't the outcome we wanted, but we're done and it feels good to be done and let's move on with our life. And part of me feels like we're able to say that because we do have a kid. We're like, let's take a step back and let's focus on this now, 7-year-old, our beautiful daughter. And let's make life what we can at this point.
Not that there's any blessing to, having to experience that, but that probably helps you connect with the people that you're helping, at Seattle Sperm Bank so much better, because you know what that struggle is like, what that pain of having loss and, negative pregnancy test after negative pregnancy test or, a failed pregnancy, or I don't want to call it a failed pregnancy, but a pregnancy lost, or implantation issues, things like that
right.
come up that people struggle with that. Like it's not easy and it's not fun for anybody. And it's harder when you're trying to explain that to someone, and then it's just hard for them to understand what that emotion feels like,
Right.
So having someone on the other side who's helping them, with this process can really be nice for them to really be able to truly empathize with that feeling.
Right. I 100% hate that anyone has to go through any of that, but it did give me a different perspective. I had empathy for it before, but it's a different empathy when you've walked in those shoes. I gave myself the injections. I remember we had a trip to Disneyland and I was putting vaginal progesterone inserts in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. I can't believe this is something that people do, or
yeah.
They drop off all the meds to your house and it's so expensive. And you're just like, I'm responsible for this now. I can inject medication. I don't have a certificate. I don't have any training. And even the vaginal inserts, I was literally looking for instructions. And I'm like, there's only one way this goes in. I felt like I still needed someone to explain it. So now being on, this side and you have a patient come to you and they're like, ooh, I've got an egg retrieval coming up, but I'm like, okay, you're going to need an ice pack. You're going to need, you know, and just, and the, in like the emotional roller coaster you go through, you know, it really, mm-hmm. I was crying and in the trenches, and it was just like, everything was going okay. I was still like crying, and it was just, it feels like a burden to have to go through that process.
And so how did you end up at Seattle Sperm Bank? So, you know, having had all this experience, you know, personal and professionally, how did you end up at Seattle Sperm Bank?
So while I was still in school, I was my ultimate goal was to work in a fertility clinic, you know, and work in the lab side and help create those embryos. But while I was in school, I got picked up by a company. So there's other companies that work alongside the fertility industry. You have different... you've got the pharmacy and the medications, you've got the devices that they're using in the lab. So I got picked up by a company, and then kind of explored the other side of fertility support and care. And it's amazing. I love being on this side. I still feel like I'm in the world. I get to go visit clinics, which led me to at Seattle Sperm Bank. There's another woman who works alongside me, and we were great friends going to these fertility conferences together. And so I jumped at the chance to work with her and never looked back. So I started at Seattle Sperm Bank in 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic. Yeah.
At this really great time.
Yeah. And so when I had started at Seattle Sperm Bank, I found out, I want to say 2-3 months later, that I was pregnant with that first pregnancy that resulted in a loss. And so this journey kind of was alongside me while I was at Seattle Sperm Bank. And ended up, you know, that journey was tough, but Seattle Sperm Bank was such a supportive place to be at for that. Colleagues were so understanding about all of it, you know, oh, you're going to a doctor appointment. You don't have to explain anything else. It's a doctor's appointment. And yeah, it was so then I ended up at Seattle Sperm Bank after all of that. And I've stuck around. It's such a great place. It feels good to be here. But also other people on the team have also gone through similar things. You know, we have other people on staff who've gone through IVF and egg retrievals and, you know, adoption and all these different pathways. So it felt like a nice, it's a human place to work.
How did Seattle Sperm Bank come to be?
Yeah, so it's been around for about a decade. And we ship sperm across the whole U.S. and internationally. It started off as part of the European Sperm Bank and separated into like European Sperm Bank is now European Sperm Bank, and they cover over there. And Seattle Sperm Bank became its own entity after that. So for the past a little over 10 years, they've just been operating as SSB. Yeah. And I think, you know, I may be a little biased, but I think they do a really good job at being sperm experts. You know, and that's really what we do. That's all, you know, we're shipping sperm and sperm logistics and getting donors. So it helps us focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so the whole sperm. I have to be honest, because I know nothing about sperm. I know nothing about sperm. But it's completely mysterious to me. I don't know what happens. I don't know, like, what happens to the sperm or anything like that. So can we kind of just do the basics of like sperm banks? So like, you know, storage, what happens after a donor donates, and, you know, where do you find donors? You can, you know, generally speaking, or at Seattle Sperm Bank, either or.
Yeah. I can say in general, sperm banks, I believe they all operate pretty similar. You know, you're going to have, you know, someone's going to go check out a donor profile. So it's going to be all the information about a donor, and they're going to look through them and kind of say, oh yeah, this guy looks like he's the perfect donor for my family building. For whatever reason that may be, you know, people gravitate because of an ethnicity or, you know, the way that he looked, and, oh, it looks like, you know, they have characteristics that'll fit in the rest of my family. and you'll purchase your vials of sperm. So they're mostly sold in little vials, and each vial is an attempt. Some clinics will want you to do different treatment with that. So they might ask you to buy two vials at a time for your treatment use. But for the most part, one vial is one treatment. And we always, you know, try to warn people, you know, estimate about three attempts per child that you're trying to have. So you're going to purchase those and then you ship them. You either store them with us or whatever bank, whoever bank you're working with, they'll hang on to them for you until you're ready to ship it for treatment use. And that's either at a clinic, it could be to a midwife, and that could be to your OB or home.
And then are there instructions to store it at home? Do you like tell people how to store it at home if they're going to get it?
Yeah. So if you're going to do a home insemination, we do send out some instructions for it because, yeah, it's going to be the same. You're going to be in the same universe as I just got a bunch of IVF meds. And like, how am I supposed to, you know, it's like the same realm. You get this vial of sperm and we ship it in a 14-day tank. So you've got plenty of time. It's going to keep it frozen until you're ready to use it. Before you ship it, you're going to want to narrow down when you need it. And that's going to be when you're ovulating. And so whether you're working with a healthcare team with that, a midwife, or whoever you're working with, or if it's just yourself and you're using your ovulation tester strips, you're going to figure out when you need that. You're going to ship it early to your home. And then we have instructions on thawing it and we put a needleless syringe. So you're going to suck up your semen sample into that syringe and you're going to insert it vaginally and you're going to push it in, plunge it down. We have partnered with a midwife and asked them to kind of write up guidance for this. So we have a blog post that's really nice and we have other kind of tips and helpful advice. And we really like pulling from the healthcare professionals on stuff like that because they're going to have more insight. Like home insemination is often less successful than doing an IUI or other types of insemination. We do have a lot of pregnancies from home insemination, but we'd never want someone to walk into it without being fully informed, especially with such like a big purchase. But yeah. And we're here for any questions. Like, I'm shipping this to my house. I think I'm ovulating on this day. When should I ship it? You know, we're here to kind of talk you through that. And I feel confident that you could talk to any sperm bank and really call them and say, I feel lost on when I should ship this or should I store this? And they're going to give you some guidance.
So, you know, you have a donor and then someone donates their sperm. What happens when they make that donation? Because there are some things that happen, right? There's like sperm gets washed or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really know. Yeah. See, I don't know.
No, these are not far off questions. You know, we hear this all the time, you know, like where are the donors coming from? So we have four different kind of donation sites. We have one in Phoenix, one in Phoenix, Arizona, another one in San Diego, California. And we have two in the Seattle, Washington area. So they're close to bigger universities, and a lot of times we're on campus and we're just talking to the college guys on campus and we're telling them, hey, we have families who need donor sperm and explaining to them what it is. So that's where we're doing a lot of recruiting. We also talk to just local professionals in the area and we'll go visit gyms and we'll, you know, cause that's where you're going to find healthy men. So healthy men typically have great sperm counts. So, you know, they're going to have better sperm counts than if you're looking at, you know, somebody who's like smoking, you know, so we're going to try to look for guys who are working out. So the guy's going to apply online and then they're going to come in and the first thing they do is a semen analysis. To get into the program. And that's where we lose most of our applicants. It's about 9 in every 1,000 applicants that make it through into the program, which is really tough. And a lot of that is just having a high enough semen and semen quality to be able to freeze it and then thaw it and then use it for treatment. So it's not saying that all of those men are infertile. It's just saying it wasn't high enough for our purposes. So when they become a donor and they come in and donate, we ask them to come at least once a week for 6 months, and they can come up to 3 times a week. That's sort of the limit of having good quality, balancing good quality and taking some rest time. So we get that sample and we do a semen analysis every time we get a sample, so that we can verify that it's staying high quality and that we know what's in there. We know what we're shipping out. We have some quality guarantees. So if a clinic goes and thaws something out and they're like, hey, those counts, the sperm counts were really low, we'll replace that for free. So we want to double check that before that goes out, because we don't want to waste all this time and effort. So we're going to take that sample. We're going to do a semen analysis. And then for the most part, we do wash it. If the donor's outstanding in his quality that he's able to produce, then we may not wash it, and we're able to add cryoprotectant, which is going to protect the sperm cells during the freeze process. And we can just freeze it without any further processing. For the most part, donors just aren't producing something that is at that level.
What does the washing do?
So the washing is essentially just putting it in a centrifuge with some media, and it separates the motile sperm cells that are swimming around from the sperm cells that are not moving. I don't want to say they're dead. They probably are, but they're not moving, so they're not useful to us. There's also other fluids in there. It's seminal fluid. It's got other things in there that you don't need. You just need sperm cells to get pregnant. So we don't need the rest of that. So we end up with just fluid that helps support the motile sperm cells, some sugar in there, help them have energy. And we add cryoprotectant to that. So it's nothing else. There's no skin cells in there. There's no white blood cells. It's just the sperm cells. And that is your washed product. And then that's really great for labs, because if you're going to put sperm directly into a uterus, it does need to be washed. Some of that fluid, if it was going through the vaginal canal and then through the cervix will wash it. So if you had a cervix being the barrier, then only the motile sperm cells are going to swim through. So if you're going to just take that sample without washing it and put it into the uterus, you're now introducing things in the uterus that normally wouldn't have been there. And some of those chemicals in there can cause contractions, and we just don't want that in there. So it's really nice that it's washed and ready to go. All of that said, you can use those wash samples for an at-home insemination if your donor just didn't have that. But the unwashed samples are great for at-home insemination. But the unwashed samples you can also ship to your lab, because they're going to wash it for you. So they can just wash it after you thaw it. So there's a lot. There's a lot that goes into that vial. So the guy comes in, we take a look at it, and we're like, okay, it looks good. We wash it, and then we freeze it. Also, we freeze a tiny portion of that we're going to thaw ourselves and double check what it looks like after it thaws out.
Oh, okay.
So we verify.
You do that with every sample?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we know. So if, a donor came in and they were able to produce, a lot of samples, it's just a small section of that batch, so to say, that we're going to thaw, and we're going to verify what's in there. So we know that what we're sending out is good.
And if it isn't, if you happen to find one that, with maybe after the thaw process didn't have very many good sperm, do you pull that sample then?
Yeah. So we'll pull those back out and we'll say, okay, that wasn't good. And we'll communicate with the donor. More often than not, that's going to kind of be, we're going to find that out during the application process, and that'll stay standard. What we sometimes see is, as guys are donating and staying in the program, we'll see the sample quality sometimes dip, and then we'll speak with them and say, hey, we couldn't use that for treatment. Did you start any supplements? Did you change anything in your life? Did you have a fever? Did you get in a hot tub? So we communicate with them and let them know whether their samples were usable for treatment or not. It's a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think knowing that there is quality control is really important too. So knowing that, you know, you're not just getting any sample is good to know. And then as far as like screening goes for the donors, is there like a genetic screening, family history? What does that look like?
Yeah. So I feel like our screening starts as soon as they submit their application. So we will immediately ask things like, are you adopted? And if you're adopted and you don't have family medical history records, we can't accept you because then that's something we wouldn't be able to review. We're also screening for age. Our donors have to be between 18 and 39 to enter the program. We do criminal background checks on our donors. And, you know, and this is all to, you know, that's kind of like a bigger part of the screening process. And then we get into, after they do the semen analysis, that's another stop point. We go into the family medical history and we're asking them about themselves and their parents, grandparents, siblings, and if they have any children. And we're going to try to look for trends for anything that could be carried to offspring. They also have a genetic carrier screening done. And we have genetic counselors on staff. So they're going to take all of that family medical history information. They're going to take the genetic screening information. And they're going to try to look to see, okay, something that would be a red flag is they had a mother who had breast cancer before the age of 40. That's going to be kind of a red flag. And it's like, ooh, you know, they may carry that gene. And that's something that could be passed off to offspring. And we don't want to cause that risk. The genetic carrier screening is interesting. It is such a large panel. It's 502 different conditions. And for the most part, someone comes back positive for something. If you look for enough things, we're all carriers of something. So a lot of times it's us reporting that, hey, we found this donor is a carrier for something, like the sickle cell trait. That's going to be great information for the egg source of the potential offspring to make sure that they aren't passing something down or creating a higher chance of something being passed down to an offspring. And then our genetic counselors are there to talk to our donors about the results and what they saw and something that they should know about their own health. But then they're also there to speak with clinics. Not all clinics have a huge genetics team. So sometimes it's nice for clinics to review that with our team. And then also any patients out there. So you may get a report back and just be like, I don't know if this donor matches. This is very confusing. Our genetic counselors are kind of like, okay, let me take a look at both of these. This looks good. This is a thumbs up. You're free to use this donor.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. And it can be, having done one of those before, a genetic screening, there's a lot to kind of I don't think I did screen. I may have done a karyotype, but either way, it's really confusing when you get a report back where there's just a lot of words and you're like, what does this mean for me?
Yes.
How does this affect me? I don't know what this means, but so that's really wonderful that you have some resources for everyone.
Well, and sometimes it's sort of like it comes back and they have one name for a condition and then another carrier has another name for a condition and it's the same condition, but you can't tell and you don't know if that's even important. And, you know, there's one I saw, it was called like maple syrup urine disease or something. And I'm like, who made that up?
Yeah.
That is not. Put this on here?
Yes, yes. And then is there a limit to how long the sperm can be frozen? Like, you know, do you have donors who come in, you know, 20 years ago or something? And well, you know, not 20, but, you know, quite some time ago, right? And then, you know, is it date stamped and then
does it expire?
Yeah, like what happens if that donor isn't used or that sample isn't used?
Right. So we recently have not had that issue. There is a huge demand for donors, but thankfully you can freeze these kinds of tissues indefinitely. So as long as it's frozen properly, it'll stored properly, it'll be good forever. As far as we know, I want to say the longest case, it was a couple years ago. It was an embryo that was thawed out after 25 years and used and resulted in a healthy baby girl. So in that, in 25 years was the longest that they had ever frozen an embryo. Embryos and eggs are much harder to freeze and much more delicate than sperm. Sperm's hardy. It freezes much easier and it thaws much easier. So I feel comfortable that if we still had a donor from the beginning of our program, that you would still be able to use them, no problem.
Okay, that's awesome. So there's, you know, a couple of things that come up when I talk to people who are looking at donors. And one of them is, you know, how do you find a donor? How do you pick a donor? And in different sperm banks, I presume, because I haven't looked at them, to be quite honest, there are different profiles and different how sperm banks will put together their profiles might differ from sperm bank to sperm bank. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think the thread that kind of ties them together is the like typical stats, the ethnicity, the education, their eye color, hair color, height, weight, blood type, you know, so those kind of stats are pretty consistent across the board. Where you get variety is like the fun stuff. So it's like, do you have adult photos, childhood photos, baby photos? Do you have, you know, the extended family history? Do you share that? There's other, you know, there's a lot of little other fun stuff. For us, our fun stuff includes a handwritten message from the donor. We do share the grandparents, parents, siblings, and if there's any offspring, we share all of that health information. And we do audio interviews with our donors. And so that's kind of the fun package you get with us. And then there's also a variety of fun questions that I think everybody asks. So it's like, what's your favorite hobby and where have you traveled and what languages do you speak? So you get to know them personally. So that's generally what, you know, that I feel like that's where it differs.
Do you find that you get a lot of questions or people asking for support or guidance in choosing a donor? So like, how do you know? There's, you know, so many different, and I know it's a very personal decision. You know, each family will have to decide what is right for them. But what are some things that you say that might help someone know whether or not the donor they are considering is the right donor for them?
Yeah, it's kind of tough. So I feel like you get somebody who has too many choices, right? There's 10 donors and I can't narrow it down. And so we'll kind of say, okay, you need to go and make a list. You know, what are the things you have to have and what are your nice to haves? You have, you know, and a lot of people have, you know, the most important things will be the genetic carrier status. You know, I'm a carrier for this. My donor can't be a carrier for that. Or ethnicity. Sometimes ethnicity is kind of a deal breaker because, you know, you look at single moms by choice, they don't want to look like the babysitter, you know, this child, they want this child to look like them. And I think that that's fair. Everyone wants, you know, their children, you know, you have this picture in your head of this family and your family looks like you. So that's fair. And then the nice to have stuff, you know, oh, it'd be really cool if they had a hobby that I liked. And so if you get down to those 10 donors and you're like, I can't decide, they can come talk to us. We do free donor consultations, free photo matching, or whoever bank that you have, they have little add-ons and things. For us, the way that we approach it is photo matching and donor consultations. And so we don't share adult photos, but you can send us photos of yourself, of your partner, of really anyone, you know, and it's like, does this donor look like this when they grow up? And we'll, because we get to know our donors and we have their candid photos, we'll say, you know what, are you looking for, you know, this kind of jaw? Are you looking for this kind of nose? And we'll take a look at the adult photo and say, you know what, this is your donor. This is, you know, or these are your top three donors. They all look like this. This guy has a jawline that looks like this. You know, this is the, you know, this guy has freckles that I know you were looking for, you know, and we kind of give some insight into that. Ultimately, it has to be your decision, you know, and it can be hard when you're kind of, you have too many choices. I think the opposite side is when you don't have enough choices. And that's something that I definitely don't want to shy away from. You know, especially looking for donors of color, it can be a hard thing. So there's kind of two ends. It's like, I'm stuck because this is my only donor choice and I don't want to keep waiting to start my family. And the other end is I have so many choices that I'm feeling stuck. And we just try to be as supportive as possible. But also these vials can sometimes sell out pretty quick. So we're like, go into it knowing what you're looking for. Maybe phone a friend. I've seen people kind of like poll their friends on profiles and just say, all right, these are my choices. Who do you like? But yeah, you can get stuck.
Yeah. And what happens if they can't find a donor that they like or that they match with? So what happens then?
Yeah. So for us, we have, you know, our team knows what donors are going to become available. Sometimes they have some insight. Like we have someone who joins a program today, their vials won't be available for 6 months due to FDA required quarantine periods. So, you know, we can kind of take that in mind and say, you know what, I'm stuck and I'm really looking for someone. And we can kind of say, okay, if we see anyone pop up that meets your needs when they become available, you know, we can let you know. The other thing we have are waiting lists. So if there's a donor and he sells out and we're like, hey, we know that those vials are in quarantine, throw you on the waiting list. When they become available, you get notified and you're able to purchase them. And, the last thing, and I really want to stress, we're never going to say, just choose someone else. You know what I mean? We don't want anyone to settle. You may have to make some adjustments. You know, you may not get a guy who's the height that you were looking for, you know, or the exact hair color that you were looking for. So you may have to make some concessions, but in the end, if we don't have a donor that meets your needs, we're going to say, go use Fairfax, you know, go use California Cryobank, because they have different donors than we do. We don't have the same donors in our program. I remember specifically this was a couple years ago. We had somebody who purchased their donor and found out that they were a carrier of alpha thalassemia, and their donor was also a carrier. So there's, we'll honor what's called a medical swap, and for free, we'll swap you out for vials who are medically compatible for you. But in this case, there were no other donors that met the characteristics of that donor. And she was sort of like stuck. And so we called Fairfax and we said, hey, this is the donor we have. There's a medical incompatibility here. Is there any way that you can send over some profiles for free and try who would match? Who's a match for this? And we sort of just kind of passed her off to their team so that she'd be able to find a donor that met her family needs, because that is, it's important, you know, and it's real.
Mm-hmm. And having said that, you know, that some donors sell out or are unavailable, is there a quantity limit to how many times a donor can donate? Is there like a regulation on that?
No. Okay. So there's no regulation on how many times a donor can donate. We put a minimum. We ask them to come in for at least 6 months and to donate at least once a week. So that there's enough. On the other end, you know, guys will stay in the program for 18 months and continue donating. Where we put the limits are on, we put family limits. So we only have 25 families per donor. In reality, we're cutting it off before then, because guys really don't produce enough vials. You know, it could take 3 attempts or more to achieve a pregnancy, and we want to save some for siblings. So we'll turn a donor into what's called sibling only. So they could be still donating, but it's only going to like a sibling only pool of families. But yeah, so the guidance, you know, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine has had the guidance of 25 donors per a city of 800,000. And so we just took that and said, you know what, 25 families per the entire US, and we left it there. And that's sort of a standard that I see at a lot of banks. I know some of them have lower limits, than that, I have not seen anyone with a higher limit of that.
So there are some unique qualities that kind of brought us to this conversation to begin with, because that's how Kristen kind of found you guys. So, you know, what are some of these things that kind of set Seattle Sperm Bank apart?
Thank you, Kristen. Shout out to Kristen. I appreciate you. She was so wonderful. She shared her story with us and allowed us to share it on our page. And she did a guest blog post. It's so meaningful to get feedback from somebody who actually went through it with us on that end, because it's different than being on this end. I think things that set us out apart are transparent pricing. I think, you know, we charge for our all access pass, we charge for our vials, and we charge for shipping. Our vials come with free storage. It just depends how many vials you buy. And you can always add more storage and you'll get charged for that. But I think we have very like clear and a straightforward way to use our website and to get vials to you. I think we have a really great system of support from start to finish. So if somebody came to us and said, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I really want to be a parent, then we're going to handhold them through that whole process. Or if somebody came to us and they said, you know what, I got it all locked down, I just don't know how to schedule shipping, you know, and we'll help you as little or as much as you want. And it's that personalized care you get. We've got team members like myself who've gone through IVF cycles. We have other people who have similar stories with adoption and who are LGBT members of the LGBTQ community. And so who really understand being in that patient position of family building from different perspectives. And so I feel like we're just really good at connecting on a human level with that. And I think the last thing that really sets us apart is we're 100% open ID. So all of our donors have agreed to being open ID, and it's not a decision you have to make today. It's just there.
And do you know what drove the decision to be 100% open ID? Because are you, I don't know that you know the answer to this, but are you one of the few or only that are 100% open ID, or are there other sperm banks that are like that?
I think that it's an option at most banks that you can choose. I'm trying to think. There might be a couple that are still anonymous. But for the most part, you can at least choose to be open ID at your, or choose anonymous at each sperm bank. For us, it feels like the right thing to do to have that be an option down the line for offspring. It's really for them. It's for the donor conceived offspring. When they turn 18, they can come to us and say, I'd like to meet my donor. And we'll kind of facilitate that contact between them. And it just feels like the right thing to do, you know, human connection, and everyone's going to want to know who, you know, who their donor was, you know, and donors want to know, you know, well, what happened to that donation that I made? You know, I know that it was more than just a donation. And it just feels good to make those kinds of connections. I think the other part of that is 23andMe and Ancestry. No one's anonymous anymore. And it's nice that we get to counsel our donors at the beginning as they're going through the application process that, hey, this is how we operate, but also 23andMe and Ancestry exist. And you could have a cousin who uses 23andMe and someone can find you that way. So it's sort of like not if, but when someone finds you, they're kind of mentally ready for that.
There's also something else that you guys do, right? You guys have a sibling registry kind of thing?
We do. We have an internal sibling registry called SSB Connects. I think most sperm banks do this now, though, have an internal sibling registry, which is a great way to get in contact with families who've used your donor. For us, it's like a message board kind of platform. It's not super exciting, but it is verified. So, you know, it's not everyone can sign up. You can't Google search and find it. You have to be invited to it. And you're going to be connected with families who, have used your donor in like kind of a little group. So when you're talking to everyone, you all use to the same donor, and it's going to be anonymous. So you are welcome to share your name. I've seen families take this offline and meet in person, or just take it to a Facebook group where they can share pictures because they've gotten comfortable with each other. But if you're not comfortable and you're just like curious, you can kind of dip your toe in without having to reveal too much about yourself. And it's kind of this nice safe space. So I really love that it exists. And yeah, again, people can join for free. They just have to submit a birth report with us. We love getting those birth reports. It helps us keep track on our donors and how many pregnancies and births we've had. And it's also what we'll use down the line to verify that that donor-conceived offspring and that donor for that connection. So birth reports are awesome.
And we may have covered a portion of this, but just to kind of bring it all together. So when a family comes to you and they're looking for a donor, can you kind of walk us through that process beginning to end?
Yeah. So someone's going to come to us. They're going to come to our website. That's the best place to kind of find all the information. You're going to take a look at donor profiles. If you look at them without purchasing a pass, there's no pictures or fun stuff, but you can see ethnicity, education, height, weight, eye color, all those things. You're going to dig as deep as you want on there. You're going to find your donor. You're going to
Sorry, let me stop you for a second. The fun stuff you said was audio recordings. Pictures. What were they again?
Audio recording. We do baby and childhood photos. We do handwritten message. There's a full extended profile that gets into, are you left-handed? Are you right-handed? You know, what kind of jawline do you have? What are your hobbies? You know, why did you choose to become a donor? We just ask them, you know, tell us. People want to know. We ask them, about a good childhood memory or languages they speak. We ask them how good they were at math. You know, was math your subject? Was it a different subject? So you kind of get to know them. The audio interview is really fun too, because it's sort of like, hey, how are you doing? And then, you know, you get kind of like this relaxed conversation. But yeah, that's all the additional stuff you get with the donor.
And then the audio conversation is just like, is just that a conversation? Is it different like from donor to donor? Are there like, it's not like a like an interview where they ask the same questions of each donor? Is it just like, you know, a conversation between two people that's recorded?
It's a conversation between two people that I think over time the questions change a little. We try to get them to talk about themselves and be very relaxed, but we'll ask them, you know, why did you choose to become a donor? And what are you doing in your life right now? And what do you want to be doing, you know, when you grow up? What do you want to be? And just like these kind of personality questions, and we get them talking. They're not super long, but it's just like a quick chat, and you get to hear their voice and kind of get to know who they are and who they are in this snapshot of time. Because in 18 years, they could, you know, they could have done something different. But it's a nice little thing.
Do you ask them to come back to update any of these things? Like, you know, if it's been, you know, a year or something, then do you have them come back and say like, hey, let's do another update?
Yeah. So when our donors retire from the program, we send them and we ask them for updates every year. The most important part of that update is really so we can keep track of their health status. So some years go by and it's like, oh man, turns out I have a genetic diagnosis that I didn't know, or someone in my family had something that we didn't, you know, didn't get tested for and nobody knew about. They can then tell us about that. And that's where we're going to have our genetic counselors and our medical, we have a doctor that we have, and they'll kind of read it and take a look at it and say, okay, do we need to tell our families about this? Does this put their offspring at risk? So that is the heart of that questionnaire. But we sometimes get little updates about like, oh, I ended up changing my degree, or, you know, little things. So we'll keep up to date as much as we can on them.
And so, okay, so you have the family, they come in, they look at the profiles. Let's say they struggle with picking a donor, then they can do a consultation with you. Or what was the other thing they could do?
photo matching. So they're going to send us some pictures and they're like, I think I like these donors. This is what I want them to look like, though. Do these donors look like that?
Okay. And then so, okay. So let's say they get through that part and then they select their donor. So what happens after they select their donor?
So you can do this all online from your account with us. You click on your vial, you purchase it in like a little shopping cart, and you say ship or store. And if you choose ship, then you're just going to type in your clinic's information or your home address, or store. And then it's just going to hang out with us. We're going to keep it safe until you type back in that you're ready to ship it. There's a couple of forms you have to fill out before we actually ship. But it's pretty easy.
Is there anything that anybody needs to know about shipping? So like, let's say you're in Canada, like for instance, Kristen was in Canada. Is there anything that people have to know about shipping maybe internationally or between states? Is there something that, you know, needs to be thought about ahead of time?
Yeah. So across the U.S., you're going to order from us and we're going to ship directly to you. Even if you're in Alaska and Hawaii, we're going to ship to you. The biggest thing about shipping is ship early. If you're at a clinic and they have storage and this is your month that you're going to inseminate, ship it now. You know, ship it weeks before if they can store it. If your clinic cannot store it, then ship it just 3 days ahead of time. Our standard tank will keep that vial safe or those vials safe for 7 days. So our shipping is always 2 days shipping, and that means you have 5 days. Especially as we're getting into the colder months, it breaks our heart when FedEx gets a backlog and it's stuck in a facility and we know that it's thawing. You know, we'll look at the date and we're like, we know it's not good anymore. And we've done things where we like try to attempt to ship another one, or we're just like, we know it's not going to make it at this point because the ovulation window is passed. So that always sucks. So yeah, ship early. Ship as soon as you know you need it. For international shipments, like Kristen, she went through one of our distributors. So we have a distributor in Canada who has vials. And so we'll replenish our distributor with a much larger tank than we send to anybody here. And they'll keep them there. So they'll figure out the logistics through that distributor. And the same thing with other countries. So a couple of countries, we have distributors. Australia, we have distributors. In the UK, we're part of the Brighton Fertility. So you can go check them out if you're in the UK, if you happen to be a UK listener. So you can purchase from them and you're getting our donors. So we'll have to work with whatever international regulations and requirements. Sometimes we can ship directly to clinics and sometimes we have to ship to a third party. It just depends on the country. But if you are shipping internationally, just send us an email. We've got a whole team who works on it and they'll figure out who you need to talk to and how we can possibly get shipments there.
And are there any other questions we didn't cover that you feel like a lot of patients will ask about?
I think a lot of people sort of get stuck in the whole like timeline of it. You know, if you're trying to use donor sperm to, you know, you're trying to get pregnant this month and you're ovulating in 2 weeks, you got to purchase those vials, you know, ahead of time. So give yourself a couple of months to find your donor. Give yourself some time to go establish care with either it's an OB or a midwife or a nurse practitioner, whoever you're establishing care with, go ask them, you know, medical questions, make sure that you're ready because it's such a big purchase. So we want to make sure you're set up for success. Even if you're shipping to your home, we require that a clinician signs off on that before we ship it. So it's a great opportunity to spend your time looking for donors, talking with them, figuring out your plan. If you know you're going to have multiple pregnancies or you're going to carry one pregnancy and your partner's going to carry another pregnancy, make sure you buy plenty of vials because sometimes this is it. Sometimes a donor only donates for those 6 months and we don't have any later. Here's a great tip. If you have someone in your life who you would like to use as your donor, as your sperm donor, we can facilitate that. We do known donors and directed donors. And those are slightly different depending whether you're sexually intimate with this person or not. But if you happen to be near one of our labs, or you fly into one of our labs or drive into one of our labs, we can assist in screening, doing a semen analysis, doing a 6-month quarantine hold if required. So that way you can use someone who you personally know as your donor if you happen to have that person.
I guess I'd never thought about like what happens with known donors.
Yeah.
Because I guess I just always thought you would do like a, you know, you would just have them donate their sample the day of your retrieval or something. But right. I hadn't considered that, you know, maybe if they, you know, live somewhere else or whatever, that they may not right. be able to come, you know, make that donation the day of your procedure, or whatever it may be. So.
Yeah, no, and it can be hard trying to schedule. I've heard stories of people, you know, my friend is going to be my donor, and then he doesn't realize that when I'm ovulating, you need to be here. And he's like, wait, but I had a trip planned, and it's just trying to line up those schedules. So we'll do like a batch, and we'll have vials to choose. You know, we're going to do a semen analysis, but we're not going to say, oh, you're not in the program. And so we're going to say, this is the result you got. And if it happens to be very low, we'll have some warning attached to that. But it's great because then we can also do the STI testing and make sure it's not has anything infectious. We can also do genetic screening. That part's optional because not, you know, sometimes people feel confident about it. But yeah, we can kind of like make sure this is a safe and effective treatment source for you, even though they're your friend.
Okay, there are a couple of questions, and I think you had answered these earlier, but I'll just ask them again for emphasis. this first question is, do you have counselors to walk you through the process? How do you decide on a sperm bank?
Yeah, so for you to decide on a sperm bank, I think you need to think about what's important to you. You know, do they have the donor you're looking for? That could be pretty important. Do they have services to help support you that you'll need? You know, if you don't need a donor consultation or extra guidance, you could just walk in and grab it, then it's not going to be as important. And then are you looking for someone who's open ID? Are you looking for that internal sibling registry? All of those kinds of things to help get you through your journey. And that will help narrow down banks. No matter what bank you're choosing, just make sure that they're a licensed tissue bank and you're going to be all good. And then things to help you, you know, walk through the process. Every bank's going to have their donor consultation type of service. So really just reach out to them. They're going to be the experts on the donors that they have, and they're going to be able to support you know, all your questions. You know, what vials do I need? You know, when should I ship? How many should I purchase? They can kind of help guide you through that. And then for us, we also have the addition of the genetic counselors who, if you happen to know you're a carrier for something or you've done screening, they can give you that extra bit of help.
And the next question, are the donors anonymous or can the child contact them after 18?
The child can connect with them after they're 18, 100% of the time. It's nice because it's not a decision. Again, it's not a decision you have to make today because that can be a lot. You know, and you're in the middle of purchasing a vial and you're like, oh, do I need that? Does my kid need that? Are they going to ask? Am I a bad parent if I don't get that? Don't worry about it. It's an option. You can put it in your back pocket and save it for later.
Yeah, I really think it's awesome because, and I'm not sure if other people know this, but I think I've talked about this a few times. I've kind of have dipped my toe into egg donation and meaning looking at egg donors. And at the time when I first started looking at it, I had no idea the impact of anonymous versus open ID. I didn't consider it. I didn't think about it because honestly, I didn't know. And so as I kind of explored the topic a little bit more and learned a little bit more about it, I started to understand and kind of hear the impact of having an open ID donor, whether, you know, sperm or egg. And so, you know, if people haven't looked into that, I think it's a really great thing to kind of explore. And just to kind of hear and understand, because I certainly didn't know about it. And, you know, complete honesty, I just didn't think I just didn't know. And you just don't know what you don't know. And so I encourage people who are looking at donors to really explore these different topics under, you know, the things that impact donor-conceived people to kind of see if, you know, for their own family and children in the future, what that might mean for them. So I just think it's really great to have that discussion. So, I mean, I think it's awesome that you're talking to your donors about it and your families about it too.
Yeah, it's kind of a hard, it's a hard thing to try to predict how you're going to feel later, especially right now. You're kind of under duress. You're like, I'm just trying to have a kid. I'm not trying to plan their entire life at this moment. And it really is like the beginning of making those parental decisions. It's the start of it, because there's a million decisions you're going to make, you know, getting into parenthood. And it can be overwhelming. And if there's anything we could do to try to unload any part of the burden, but it really, I think it really is a nice connection to have. You know, it's a connection that I think people are discussing more and more, and the importance of that. And, you know, there really is going to be, like, if nothing else, that curiosity of who is the person who contributed to my life. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm looking for my donor dad. No, it's, I'm looking for the person who contributed to my family in such a meaningful way. I want, do you know, am I like them? You know, anything. And the donors too, you know, on the other end, donors are going to want to know too, you know, what happened to that what became of that? Who did I help? And I know that that's what we hear on our end. You know, we get donors who, if they call and ask how many, you know, pregnancies and births their donations have resulted in, we tell them, we share that with them. And if a family shares anything, you know, any handwritten messages to us, which they do, and the donor asks for it, we'll hand it to them. We won't tell them, we won't prompt it, but if they ask, then that is something we'll share with them. So donors are curious, and I think it helps both ends.
And I think this is so great. I mean, we've talked about so many things today around sperm donation, sperm donor, sperm bank. So thank you so much for sharing, but I'm sure there will be more questions. And if people have more questions, what's the best way to contact you, reach you, or, you know, try and see what's available at Seattle Sperm Bank?
Yeah. So you can check us out on our social media platforms. We're at Seattle Sperm Bank on both Instagram and Facebook. And you can just check out our website, seattlespermbank.com. There's a cool chat feature right on there. So if you don't feel like having a full voice conversation, you can find our email on there, cs@seattlespermbank.com. We'll connect you with our client services team. And there's our phone number is all over our site. So go ahead and check that out. And we're here to help. Either you're looking for donor sperm, you have more questions about it, or you're just curious, reach out to us. We're happy to answer.
No, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for sharing all your knowledge and everything about sperm banks. Because like I said, it was a complete mystery to me. And I figured it would be a nice way to kind of do a little dive into sperm banks, what it's like, how to, you know, look at different profiles and then what happens to the sperm, especially for people who are just getting into this process or deciding that this is the right path for them. Sometimes getting into the space can be really overwhelming and you don't really know where to start before you start. And so sometimes hearing, you know, what the process looks like can be a little more calming, at least during the process. So thank you for sharing everything today with us.
Of course. I love being able to provide resources and do anything to make this journey easier. I have been on that side and there's nothing easy.
No, definitely not. But yes, in the future, if anything else comes up and we can talk more sperm, I'd love to have you back to have a deeper conversation about sperm.
Yes. We can get into like the shape of them, how they swim.
Yes, most
they're
definitely
journey through the fallopian tube.
For sure. Well, thank you so much. You have a great night and I will talk to you soon.
I want to thank you for tuning in today. I hope you found today's episode helpful. As always, please share with anyone who may find value in our conversations. And if the mood strikes you, please feel free to donate to the podcast or leave a 5-star review so we can get more listeners to hear these stories and resources. I will have a link in the show notes along with the books that we discussed on this episode. They'll be linked to my Amazon shop. Your purchase with that link helps me offset the costs of running the podcast, so I'd be so grateful if you opted to buy any of the books we discussed on the show through that link. Thank you to everyone who is part of the 40 and Infertile community. I am so grateful for all of you, and I hope to continue bringing you more content that helps you in your quest to parenthood. If you want to have a question or topic covered in future episodes, please feel free to reach out to me on Instagram at 40andInfertile.